Hello, if you enjoyed this podcast, you can support us. Just need to click on the link and become an Acast supporter. It's a one-off donation. You can give as much or as little as you like, and there's no commitment, but it certainly helps us to keep producing these podcasts. So thank you very much.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ideas in writing.
Hello, I'm Philip Holden, and this is Ideas in Writing, the podcast where we talk to people who use words, written, spoken, performed, and even sung, as those of you who heard Tom Carradine and Ian Tucker Bell the other week. Ideas in Writing is produced with the support of Mr. Books Bookshop in Tunbridge, the home of inspiring, imaginative, and intelligent books, gifts, and conversation. In this episode, I talk to the ever-so-friendly Liam Drew, author of Fire Mammal, which is a hugely entertaining book about what it means for us to be a mammal. And it's not as simple as it seems. I first met Liam a couple of years ago when he came to talk at a science book event we arranged at the old fire station. Liam's word for this episode was connection, whilst mine for some reason was autocorrect. I thought it'd be a terribly clever word, but it really wasn't. Liam was very tolerant, though. We talked about Liam's book, of course, but also his writing for Nature and other magazines and The Guardian, amongst others. We talked about what makes science writing good and how Liam made the transition from being a neuroscientist studying the senses and epilepsy to a freelance writer. We discuss brain implants, the need for a human perspective on science stories, scientists, pandemics, anti-vaxxers, all kinds of things. So you can check out Liam online. The best place to find his work, I think, is to go to the homepages of Nature or New Scientists and search for him. So, much to talk about, and I think we might have to ask Liam back for a future Ideas in Writing. So here we go. This is Connection Autocorrect with Liam Drew. So, hello, Liam.
Hi, Phil. How are you doing?
I'm all right, thank you. How are you?
Yes,
where,
I'm well.
Where are you? That's a good question.
I'm in East Sussex, hunkered down. This week I'm in my mother-in-law's house, which is empty, but for my family. Enjoying the November weather.
Yes, it is a bit like that, isn't it? But I'm sure it'll all come good again. Thank you for joining me. As you know, we start off with a couple of words that we hope kind of prompts questions. I likened it to Ready, Steady, Cook. You remember that? When you bring along a carrier bag with with your ingredients in, and we see what we can make out of it.
I feel like the last four months of my life have been an episode of Ready Steady Cook.
Really?
You know, sort of reduced trips to the supermarket.
Yeah, no, I remember you saying something in the book, I Mammal, about your love of cooking, or is it not necessarily a love? It's an obsession, is it?
Well, it was a love before lockdown. No, it's all fine. No, I do very much like cooking. It's just funny with these reduced trips to the supermarket. It's
Yeah.
I've just found the calculations.
Yeah, I've just found we've had too much food because, you know, when you go there less often, you think, oh, I must get. And then I think that's one of the reasons why I'm eating too much as well, because, you know, obviously it's there. It's in the fridge. It's got to be eaten. It can't go to waste.
Exactly.
But I can't remember. It was a few years ago we met, wasn't it? Talked about your book at the old fire station.
Yeah, we did. Yeah, I guess. Yeah, probably about 2 years ago now. The book came out nearly 3 years ago.
Yeah,
that was a good night, wasn't it? It's a lovely venue, though.
And I really enjoyed the evening, and I enjoyed your book as well. I wanted to start off really by I thought the best way into it is saying, What's on your passport for you as your occupation? I'll let you have your glass of wine. That's fine.
I presume it still says neurobiologist. I've not checked it for some time.
No.
Yes, neurobiologist. Yeah, I changed career about 4 years ago, so it's still out of date.
So what is neurobiology then?
So that's basically the study of the nervous system, which was my career, I guess, from the age of 22, starting a PhD, through to the age of roughly 38, 39. Well, and that's when I left the lab, so I left academic neuroscience to sort of pursue a career in science writing or writing.
Mm. And I know you write a lot for Nature and some other journals. I floated the idea of you joining me. I had this idea that we were going to talk about kind of science communication, which is essentially what your job is now, isn't it?
Yeah, no, exactly. So I'm freelance and have been since I left the lab. So my jumping off point was writing the book part-time in my spare time in my final time at UCL. And then I was doing that, and that was sort of my springboard into a freelance career. So I mainly write, like you say, I write often for Nature. That's a fairly regular gig. And then various other sort of outlets, most of them sort of science-based, a couple of pieces in The Guardian. I enjoyed last year doing some lectures for sixth form students, which was really rewarding. And so, yeah, it's nice to sort of try and have a bit of diversity. I'm just finishing off a kid's book, actually, with DK Publishing. Yeah, so an introduction to the brain for 7 to 9-year-olds. And that's been a really fun project, actually.
Oh, that sounds really good.
Just getting the proofs back now, so... Yeah, it's great. One of the perks of my job is when I was an academic and whenever anything needed illustrating, it was me and my really bad PowerPoint or Photoshop skills. Yeah. Now I get to work with professional illustrators. And so I sent DK my terrible PowerPoint slide saying, oh, I think it should look a bit like this. And then these wonderful designers come back with these two-page
That's
spreads.
Good. So this is Dorling Kindersley. Did they approach you for the book?
Yeah, they did. Yeah, they were looking for a writer, a sort of popular science writer. It was a little bit of a fortuitous situation. I think I can say this. The editor's cousin is an academic neuroscientist, and he contacted her saying, "Would you be the consultant editor on this project?" Because they like to have a professional neuroscientist check that everything's legit. And then he happened to say to her, "Do you know anyone who might be a good fit for the project?" And she said, "Well, as a matter of fact, my friend Liam, who I studied with at UCL, is now a science writer, and he has an 8-year-old and a 6-year-old daughter. So he could be a good fit." So then DK
came
to me.
That's fine. That's, you know, that's being in the right place at the right time, isn't it, really? But you're so with that background, I mean, first of all, I think you've said some things about how frustrating academic life was. do you still feel that, or do you sometimes think, I wouldn't mind the regular salary?
Well, I spent my whole academic career on sort of 3-year contracts, thinking that was completely an insecure way to live, and now I freelance, and it looks terribly secure looking back on it. Academia has its has its problems. I had a good time there. There was ups and downs. There's a lot of pressure to publish, and there's a lot of pressure to publish fancy, exciting stories. But I think as I say on my website, it's like, you know, I met the full spectrum of humanity in that job, and I met some absolutely brilliant people, some of the smartest people I know, most brilliant scientists, and then some of the nastiest people and some of the worst scientists. But, you know, that's life, isn't it?
I guess so. Coming back to what neurobiology is, to what extent does that interact with what we think of as something like psychology?
Certainly, I guess I just use the word spectrum, but again, you know, neuroscience is a really broad spectrum. Like, from, you know, you could be a neuroscientist who studies the mechanics, how a single neurotransmitter receptor works, and you could be a neuroscientist and work very much on sort of brain activation during sort of psychological processing. And so obviously the closer you get to that end of the spectrum, the more you're interested in psychology. And I think myself, I was never quite at the level of the mechanics of single ion channels, but I wasn't far from it some of the time. So I my personal neuroscientific career, and I think that's kind of why I tend to prefer the term neurobiology, because I was definitely on the biology end of things rather than the neuropsychology end.
Okay.
So I was sort of down in the nuts and bolts of how do nerve fibers respond to touch was my PhD. Then I went off to try and work on schizophrenia, which was incredibly challenging, but still at the sort of level of how genetic mutations that predispose human beings to schizophrenia affect the basic functioning of nerve cells. So down in that level of science. And then again, I was working on sort of function of hippocampus and why that particular brain structure uniquely in the mammalian brain has new neurons brought into it throughout adulthood, and sort of looking at the integration of neurons into existing circuits and how they sort of wire up and how that might affect higher function, but always sort of at a slight distance from the higher functions.
Yeah. But it's interesting, because then you kind of, for your book, you kind of zoomed all the way out and said, let's look at this whole class of animals, which is a huge field, as it turns out. So How did that come about?
Well, it's interesting. I can't remember if I say this in the book or if it was very, I've always been interested in evolutionary biology. And I think Richard Dawkins' books when I was a teenager, sort of a quarter of a century ago, and Stephen Jay Gould's books, and like evolutionary biology was what made me fall in love with science and biology. And I kind of feel that there's a slight increase in interest in it now. But I think, honestly, during my career, I felt that evolutionary biology was a sort of, as an angle on neuroscience, was largely absent. So I sort of fell into my book accidentally. It's funny, as I've not been promoting the book for a while, I've not told the story for a while. But as you know, having read the book, I got struck in a delicate part of my anatomy by a football. And I just asked a simple evolutionary biology question of why would male mammals carry their essential reproductive organs on the outside. And that was sort of this platform for me to go off and look at evolutionary biology. And then I became a father and sort of got obsessed with these other mammalian traits, so wombs and lactation. I just love the perspective. And I think I just really enjoyed that zooming out. And quite possibly because it was in such stark contrast to my incredibly focused academic career. I mean, it's a well-accepted fact now that the majority of academic scientists become increasingly expert in increasingly narrow fields. And that's fine. That's what it takes sometimes to achieve things in academia. But it's interesting. I just wrote a story for Quantum magazine, and there was a collaboration between a behavioral ecologist who studied the movement of sharks, and he had a hypothesis about the way they moved, and he started collaborating with someone who works on the movement of fruit fly larvae. And the two of them just produced this beautiful collaboration. But I think there was just, they met because each of the respective scientists, she, the Drosophila larvae expert, had started reading about movement patterns and foraging, and he had started to think about the neurobiology of the patterns of movement he saw in his sharks, and they just came together. And I thought just something really exciting came out of that collaboration, and I do think that. And when I spoke to him, David Sims, we sort of spent the last 20 minutes of the interview just talking about that and how it can be fruitful to step outside of your immediate discipline and just collaborate and think differently and get different perspectives and get different people in the room.
So that's so, no, because it sounds to me like the sort of what you find exciting or kind of stimulating now is you know, the kind of research of a much wider range of, you know, kind of pursuing your interest rather than having to stay very focused on something very, very small and restrictive in a way. Is that fair?
It's a double-edged sword. The bit that cuts you and hurts is that you're like, oh, here I go again, starting afresh. So I write a feature and I've got sort of 2 weeks or a month to sort of dig into a brand new topic. And sometimes that can be really laborious when you just realize how much there is to know about it. But it's also, I mean, the real plus side, the edge that's kind of sharp and exciting, if that doesn't make me sound like some sort of masochist, the thing that sharpens you is that sort of new discovery. And it can be really exciting. Right now, I'm just immersed in the biology of migraine. I'm going to be doing some stuff on the brain's immune system. I've learned about cystic fibrosis last month. So yeah, that traveling around, yeah, when it's not overwhelming, that's the real perk of this job.
Yeah, that sounds good. And I think there's a kind of flavor of that in the book, in the sense that it is such a broad area, and the sort of the different fields that have kind of illuminated what it means to be a mammal are quite diverse, you know, from sort of genetics and sexual reproduction through to diet and microbiology in terms of the gut, and there's a huge kind of mass of science that's maybe quite right widespread that kind of has to pull together, or somebody has to pull it together. Thankfully, you've done it in a much more readable, digestible way. So that's kind of what I liked about it, because it in terms of reading it, because I'm clearly not a scientist, it does entertain you through that, and it does a lot of that work for you. I'm just looking at my notes here, and I just realized I've completely forgotten what we started off intending to do as we talked about this, because I asked you to bring along a word, didn't I?
You did.
So what word? I know you had difficulty deciding on the word, but what was the
word? I always have difficulty deciding on words, yeah. It's funny, I was just about to leap in as you were talking about my book to say we didn't say our words, because I think it's kind of pertinent. The word I went for was connection.
Now, that's interesting. Well, I mean, it's interesting in itself. Okay. Shall I tell you what my word was?
Well, please do.
And I nearly changed it, actually. Well, I did change it, actually, but then I nearly changed it again. I chose the word autocorrect.
That's interesting.
Well, I can explain why if you like, but let's go with connection first. So, so what was the thinking?
Well, yeah, I mean, half the reason I was going to leap in and say this, it's just I should have rehearsed this, given that I chose the word. No, I think it's basically the fact that I think as I've evolved as a writer, or tried to evolve as a writer, it's just a growing appreciation that what makes good writing powerful is a sense of connection. It's like it's when you sit down with a good book and you just feel so attached to this writer. You know, I'm doing it right now. I'm reading Gay Talese, the old sort of New York Times and Esquire writer. And, you know, just that it's just a wonderful thing to have someone there with you, present. And I think, and Rebecca Solnit is another thing I've been reading lately, and she has this, she has this wonderful line where she says the objects that we call a book are not really a book. A book is more like a musical score or a seed. And so, it's, you know, no one would consider a piece of music to be the musical score. The music exists in the playing. And so I think she's sort of saying that, you know, a book only exists in the reading. And so I think that's what I'm talking about with sort of connections, is that you're trying to lay something down. Like, here I am sat in a house by myself that has to come alive in the mind of another reader. And if that happens, if my voice is animated and somehow moving you as you read my book or my essays or my articles, then that's what it's about. And that's what I'm sort of striving to do. And I think the methodology that's involved differs from project to project. So it was just interesting to hear you when you were talking about my book and sort of saying that I was sort of keenly exploring these new areas to me. I was sort of very mindful that was, I wouldn't say I was in character. I mean, it was definitely me writing the book, but I was aware that I was doing that quite nakedly on the page. It was like, you know, this is new to me. You know, I'm learning this. You know, I'm not, if I write about neuroscience, I sort of have a more academic pose. I certainly did as an academic. Now, when I write for Nature, I certainly have a, not distant, I still need to connect, but the rules are different. Whereas with the book, I was able to say, this is me going on a journey of self-discovery, although I hate that phrase. But yeah, it was a personal mission to sort of learn something about the biology that makes me a mammal. And so that was the sort of tone and style of that book. And so I think every piece has its own tone and its own style, and somehow that has to connect with the reader.
Yeah. I think when you said connection, I was thinking, yeah, there's a process that you've gone through very successfully in this book, which is connecting up these very disparate bits of evidence and different perspectives. But you're quite right. There's another sense in which you do have to feel a connection with the writer, or in this case, if you like, that character of the explorer who has to be consistent through the book as well. And I think that's a real talent in terms of it's not just conveying information, is it? It's, as you say, there's a sort of sense of empathy with this person discovering, which of course is realized brilliantly, as you say, in that first story, the first page, as you get hit by the football. It just evokes empathy amongst many people to start with. So yeah, I nearly tried to find a word that was something to do with evolution. I thought evolution itself was probably too obvious. but maybe I'll tell you why autocorrect came up, because I was thinking about artificial intelligence, and I think you've written something about that as well. So maybe we can talk about that. I was thinking the kind of augmentation of human faculties through very simple, very familiar things like autocorrect or predictive text. And I realized, I looked up that autocorrect only went into the Oxford English Dictionary in 2011, and it should be hyphenated as well. but nobody does. In fact, autocorrects the word incorrectly. But yeah, so I maybe we'll come on to the sort of artificial intelligence, sort of augmented intelligence in a bit. But let's go back to what I think is important about the role, if you like, of science communication. And I think that's one of the things that struck me thinking about our conversation was that very often the way we talk about evolution in a sort of conversational way, but very often, you know, television documentaries and so on, is actually quite misleading. You know, the idea of, we talk about structures designed to do a job.
Yeah, there's a tricky one, that. And I know it almost gets into philosophy of biology, I think. And some of the people that sort of talk about using artificial intelligence to sort of try and decipher what the brain does are getting into debates about this, and sort of saying something has a function. But yeah, I mean, we do tend to think that evolution purposefully sort of moves toward something that has a function. And of course it's not. It's just haphazard, and it's whatever works. But, you know, it's a deeply conservative process. Once something is functioning and doing something that's vital for life, it tends to stick around. So I think another sort of misleading thing is we always sort of think about evolution as sort of creating, but it's often sort of keeping. I'm not sure if that's a great answer, but yeah.
No. I mean, I think the what strikes me also, and it sort of partly came out when I was looking at your book again, was that all of these, everything that we identify as kind of an evolutionary step or change in an animal has to have a very direct link to reproductive success as well, doesn't it? It's not just it's a marginally better way of, you know, collecting fruit off a tree. It has to then lead to more success in terms of reproduction. And yeah, it's sort of at that level of, what's the word? It's that level of just conveying the basic mechanism, I suppose, that I think sometimes gets lost.
Yeah.
Even when we're talking
I remember thinking about this that there is a sub, teeth are really important in the evolution of mammals. So our molar teeth is sort of this very intricate sort of pestle and mortar system. It's all interlocking teeth at the back of our mouths are famously mammalian. So, you know, lizards, you know, some lizards have some sort of grinding, but most lizards just look like a crocodile. They just bite and then they swallow. I just remember thinking about it. It's like this exquisite tooth shape has been sculpted by evolution. And like you say, every intermediate step has to have a selective advantage, which increased the reproductive success of the animals that had those that tiny, tiny change in the shape of their tooth. And I'm sure that could put people off sort of believing in evolution. And I guess it's just, I guess one just has to appreciate the incredible expanse of time over which these processes happen. And it's not like, you know, I think, and it's the other thing is that it averages out over time. So it's not every animal that was born with a slightly better tooth shape went on to be a great success. You know, many of them would have died. But just overall, over the massive expanses of time that evolution happens, that these tiny advantages on average are selected for. Yeah, I mean, time was just something I just, once you go into the world of evolutionary biology, people just start talking about millions of years as if like we talk about months. It's just that's just the unit of time, and you just have to accept that that's how things happen. You know, like, oh, that species evolved so quickly, it only took 5 million years to evolve. It's like it's 5 million years, you know.
Yes.
Yeah, you need that time to be able to.
Yeah, no, I was gonna say, but I guess then what that means is that when you're telling the story of evolutionary biology, you have to kind of choose what story to tell, don't you? Because, you know, if you wanted to convey these vast amounts of time, that's a different story to conveying the, as you say, the kind of intricacy of a tooth, or, you know, the placement of testicles, however long that takes.
Yeah, well, that took millions of years too. Everything does. I mean, I had a stab at it. Actually, I think I had a longer, I think in the first draft of my book, there was a longer stab at sort of trying to just ponder deep time. And I think it got reduced down to a paragraph in the introduction, which is ironic that they wouldn't give me 2 pages to consider 3 million years. But, you know, the part of that was just sort of trying to say that, you know, each page of this book deals with a million years of history. And so each, I can't remember what the calculations would have been. So it was almost, you know, sort of like almost each letter in this book is worth thousands of years. I can't remember what it would have been. As a rough approximation, it was definitely a million years per page.
That does kind of bring it home, doesn't it? And but you know, talking about the communicating science, as I say, it's sometimes it's not just what story you're telling. It's choosing a particular illustration or a particular, even just a particular aspect of that story.
Yeah, I mean that. Yeah, no, it's interesting you say that. That just to sort of come back to a little bit to what I was saying about just sort of character and connection, and just I think once the tone of that book had been set, and it was playful and funny, but it was also serious because it was about me becoming a father and, you know, having a premature daughter, and so, you know, I was always trying to entwine those two themes, but it was sort of very human, and it was very sort of marveling at the natural world and just saying, you know, there'd be jokes along the way, but the central theme I hope that came through was like, wow, you know, like, wow, isn't biology amazing? Isn't this incredible? Your body is like a masterpiece, and I'm just a little bit stunned by how ingenious evolution has been to create something as intricate as a mammal. Now, one day I will write another book. But right now I write features. And as I sort of say, you know, that sort of theme of connection. So my other possible choice of word had been purpose, because I think the two are connected. So with each feature, one has to work out, with each story, one has to work out the purpose of writing it. Why are you writing it? And if you don't quite know why you're writing it, I think that probably comes through in the reading of it. So you can sort of think, oh, you know, isn't subject X interesting? Let me write about it and tell you some cool stuff about subject X. But I think what I'm learning as I sort of go deeper into this career is that you're really trying, as you research a subject, you know, it can be quite amorphous to begin with, and all you know is that it's interesting. Then you have to pull out the kernel of information that you want to convey to the reader. So something meaningful and something that's just going to move them and just sort of make them look at the world a bit differently. So, you know, the piece that of mine that came out this week, there was actually if we do return to autocorrect, it came up in an article I wrote about artificial intelligence and human augmentation last year, and there was this, so I sort of included a conversation with an ethicist who'd reported on a clinical trial in which a group of individuals had devices implanted in their brains, which all these individuals had epilepsy, and these devices were going to well, they didn't know if they would work when they went in. The researchers and the company involved were hoping that these devices would detect early signs of an epileptic seizure, and they could warn them. It would make this handheld device beep, and these people could take a prophylactic dose of drugs, take themselves out of harm's way. The device was a stunning success, but the company couldn't find investors, and so they went bust. And all these people whose lives had been some of them utterly, utterly transformed for the good. Some people didn't like the devices. But there was this one main character who had been transformed by the device, and then she lost it at the end of the trial. And so I'd learned of it last year, and then this year I read a follow-up story just discussing the ethics of doing these types of clinical trials and how they presented a new type of trial that needed new ethical oversight. And this is a growing topic. And I get the message here was pretty obvious as soon as I spoke to Rita. So I hadn't spoken to her for the previous article. This time I spent an hour on the phone with her, and it was one of the most affecting interviews I've ever done in my life. She's an incredible human being. She was so depressed and anxious about her epilepsy that she couldn't leave the house before she went on this trial. She had this device implanted. It warned her of a seizure. She would take a dose of medicine. She had no seizures for 3 years. She started dating. She got married. Her life was utterly transformed for the good. And then 5 months after her wedding, she lost it. She lost the device. And so I guess my point is that I'm sort of very moved by the story. And it was just so clear that I was writing it for her. It was like, you know, and for the people that she represented. And she was very clear about that when she spoke to me. I mean, that was one of the most moving things she said. It was like, you know, this trial wasn't about me. It was about me helping other people because I know what it's like to suffer. And so, you know, it was just such a sense of purpose with that piece that, you know, people that have often lifelong debilitating neurological conditions need to be protected when they are doing a great service for technology companies trying to make a lot of money. And obviously, you know, I tried to speak to as many people as possible, and the sort of company said, well, actually, if we paid too much out in insurance, people would leave the space. It would be too expensive to enter the space. You know, I had to put that perspective in there, but it was very clear to me what the purpose of that story was. And so I think, so that felt much more like journalism to me.
Yeah.
Than science writing. And I think that's the sort of skill I'm still learning. So I still consider myself a science writer. I still love writing a story, which is, wow, look how cool biology is. I still love those stories. But just, I don't know, I guess there's just different stories to be told. And each time you embark on one, the trick is to find the sort of, even though science writing, to find the emotional core of it, I guess, and to try and convey that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you're right when you say it's journalism. There's this thing. One of the early events we had actually was with James Graham, the playwright who wrote Ink, the story of Rupert Murdoch taking over the Sun. I'm sure there's a bit in the first act there about them. The stories had to have a human in. You know, they had to have a human angle. They had to, and you had to be very particular. So it's better to look at one person than look at an issue. You know, that kind of approach. And it does see it is what you're saying. It is about connection. You connect much more easily with a person who's been through this experience than the statistic of how many people have been through this.
Yeah, it's funny you say that, actually. My first ever feature for Nature, I was about genetic testing for drug responses. And I wrote the whole thing just without a person in it. And then sort of spoke to the editor and we were like, well, it would be quite nice to have someone with personal experience of it. And I ended, and they were sort of trialing this at this big children's hospital in America, St. Jude's. And they arranged for me to speak to the mother of a child who had leukemia, who was in this program. And it kind of felt gratuitous and superfluous. I sort of spoke to her and sort of had to ask her these sort of trite questions about, you know, what did it mean to be in this innovative genetic testing? Yeah, so it just sort of felt a bit superfluous. So there can be a bit of a trope with science writing that you open with the patient, do the science, and then wrap around to the patient. And I did that in the latest story with Rita, but it was about her, and she completely was representative and emblematic of this community of people that are participants in clinical trials.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So I think it has to be used judiciously. So the second story I wrote for Nature, it was about fecal transplants for inflammatory bowel disease. And I spoke to two people who had Crohn's disease and their various takes on whether or not they would do fecal transplants or not. And it worked brilliantly. I don't know. The reader would tell you if it worked brilliantly or not. But from my perspective, it worked well because it just felt like a more honest conversation. And they taught me stuff rather than being a bolt on and just like get some emotional aspect. So, yeah, you are making those judgments. And it probably differs from outlet to outlet. Sort of mulling my career over here as we speak. But yeah, I would like, if you're writing for Nature or you're writing for The Guardian, say, you know, the ratio of human to science is gonna differ.
It's a combination of the art of writing it, isn't it? There is a kind of ethical dimension to that, which you clearly felt with the case of the parent of the leukemia sufferer. You know, how much of this story is it right for me to use, and does it does it serve the purpose? Yeah. And I think that's kind of what I was, one of the things I was thinking about with regard to explaining evolution. Do you feel a sense of duty? This is a stupid question, but do you feel a sense of duty to get the science right, is there a sort of compromise in explaining the science sufficiently to fulfill that purpose?
I feel a rigid, sometimes crippling obligation to get the science right, as right as it can be. No, it's not crippling at all. I do feel a real obligation. I mean, there is, what we're doing when we're communicating science is making it as simple as possible without getting anything wrong. So, you know, you want to know a subject well enough to know when you're straying into untruths or simplifications that do an injustice to the subject.
We can probably test that right now, because I can ask you to define what a mammal is in less than an hour.
This is one of the things we went into. I go into the book. You know, you look it up in the Oxford English Dictionary. It's an animal that drinks milk as a youngster, has fur for some of its life, and is endothermic. But obviously, a mammal is genealogically defined, and it's clade of animals, a sort of a group of descendants of animals, of something that we define as a mammal, going back sort of 220 million years. Yeah. So you know, but there is a, you know, as I sort of discuss in the book, you know, there's a baggage that comes with that definition, where you just sort of pick out a bunch of traits. It sort of makes you think that, well, it kind of goes back to connection, right? Because I think when I started out writing the book, the entire sort of table of contents that I sent to the publishers in my book proposal was a list of separate traits, you know, like, you know, fur, lactation, warm-bloodedness, and all the rest of it. And then writing the book was about connecting them all together, because, you know, an animal is not just a collection of separate traits. And so the sort of concept of a mammal, we can sort of say, you know, the most accurate definition is a clade of mammals all closely related, more closely related to one another than any other vertebrate. But what I had to sort of try and dig for a concept of a mammal. And that had to arise from how these traits interacted. And it was the most difficult thing to do. And I'm not sure it was completely satisfactory, but, you know, it's sort of a high energy, self-sustained organism. It's sort of highly adaptable. It sort of lives through eating, through consuming vast quantities of food, can have a biology that runs quite independently of its surroundings. Is that going to shift many units off the shelf? I don't know. So to go back to your original question of sort of wrestling with the science. Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of I don't knows in that book. I mean, like nearly every chapter of, like, how did lactation evolve? You know, there was sort of two main theories in play on that. How does endothermy evolve? There were sort of four or five theories in play on that, you know, and they weren't mutually exclusive by any means. And I just kind of realized when I look back at the book that nearly every chapter was like, well, we think it's this, but we don't know.
Yeah.
And I think you can contrast that with, there's quite a big appetite in science publishing these days for books with clear theses. And it's just like, this is you've never thought about life this way. It's actually this. And
yeah,
sometimes ideas can be oversold.
Well, I think that's one of the things that I enjoyed about the book, actually, was that it has that, humility. You know, it's not a textbook in any sense. And it's not, as you say, selling a particular vision of, you've never thought about mammals like this. But it does. It's quite frequently says, well, you know, this is what we think, and this is what has been said. And actually, you know, it's not quite that simple. Apropos of which, I was going to say the whole thing about reproductive organs outside the body. Just one of the many repeats of QI the other day about temperature regulation and. You know, the idea that sperm production is very sensitive to variations in temperature, and therefore that's why. Did your book decide that that's probably not the case? I can't remember now.
Well, it's funny. I think it was on a knife edge. The alternative to that is that sperm production is very sensitive to increases in temperature because testicles evolved to be outside the body, and so it became optimal to produce sperm at 35 degrees. So the alternative theory was that actually, as mammals evolved new ways of moving, which involved sort of flexing along the spinal column and generation of large waves of internal abdominal pressure, that actually it may be the pressure that was affecting the testicles' ability to produce sperm, and then they were moved down through the body. And you know, that kind of comes back to these intermediate forms, right? Because if it was temperature, they'd have to get from sort of up by the kidneys where the ovaries are, all the way down through the abdomen and out the body. And it's difficult to imagine that the intermediate steps down through the body would actually have decreased the temperature. So it's very difficult for that to account for the intermediate. So I tended to sort of side with the abdominal pressure theory. But then there was actually a paper that came out between the hardback and the paperback saying that actually the sort of relationship with body temperature and external testicles would actually support a little bit more the temperature regulation theory.
It wasn't just a randomly successful hernia.
A sort of Genghis Khan. Sired thousands of children or something. probably not. I didn't go into that theory.
Okay. All right. No. Well, I told you, I'm not a scientist. Yes, so I'm not going to go through all the traits of mammals, but the one about which... Yeah, everyone learns at school that mammals are warm-blooded, and the idea that that's not quite straightforward. I mean,
well, it's just a difficult one to explain because it takes so much. We started off this conversation talking about Ready, Steady, Cook, didn't we? It takes so much food to be an endotherm. I mean, it's difficult to know why when I go to sleep at night, or when I'm just sitting around doing nothing. And, you know, lions sit around for days doing nothing between food. Why you would keep your temperature running high, burning all these calories, because you have to go out and find those calories. So any theory of warm-bloodedness, of endothermy, has to account for why it's so advantageous to have such a increased need for calories. The optimal situation, you know, when an animal's in action, it's fantastic to be endothermic. If you were designing the system, if an intelligent designer exists, one would imagine that there would be a sort of on switch, and it's like, okay, you're in active mode, you know, go and be endothermic, keep your body temperature up the whole time, but when you're resting, turn it down. And that never happened. And so one of the theories of why body temperature came up was that actually peak metabolic rate, so the peak rate at which you could burn calories when you're sort of chasing an antelope across the savannah, actually increasing that just by necessity pulled up the basal metabolic rate. And so that's one of the biggest theories of it. But it's sort of wonderful, you know, people, that sort of evolutionary perspective is always about sort of going out and seeing if these rules hold true over all these animal species. And so some critics of that theory went out and found animals, and I'm forgetting them, which species they were, that could actually detach peak metabolic rate from basal metabolic rate. So it was like, well, if it can evolve, then why didn't it evolve? It's always a tall ask, isn't it, to sort of come up with laws of biology or theories that fit, you know, the many
My feeling is that all of these kind of classifications are kind of they're kind of temporary, aren't they? Well, you know, mammals as a category, or endothermic and ectothermic, and there's probably some creature somewhere that you say is somewhere between the two, or it's got, you know, it's, it, you know, it exhibits traits of both of these things. But the, but these classificatory systems are really kind of in the, sorry, I was just laughing at my own joke there. I was going to say, if you're a science writer, you'd say these classificatory systems are in the DNA of biology, aren't they? But they are. They're sort of the history of biology is about classifying animals.
Yeah, it's been going on for millennia. Yeah, and it's fun. There's a book out there that I've not read, which I would like to read one day. And it's called The Half-Life of Facts. And I think the central thesis of this book is that all facts are just the best approximations that we have at this present time, and facts turn over. And that, it's difficult, because whenever you're doing science, and even when you're reporting on it, you, there's always this feeling that we're sort of closing in on the truth. And, you know, even as you say that, I'm like, yeah, but our classification system right now is great compared to Linnaeus's, or, you know, Aristotle or Hippocrates. You know, we know now. But yeah, it's impossible to imagine, you know, in 100 years' time, what beliefs of mine and yours people look back and think, God, I can't believe they thought that.
Yeah. Well, I know you've written a little bit about vaccinations, for example, which is a kind of a, if not a hot topic, it's certainly a warm topic at the moment, isn't it? What was your take on that? Because I think you wrote a piece about the argument for compulsory or enforcing
mandatory. Nice.
Mandatory, that's the word.
Yeah, no, that was interesting to me. It was another one of those features where I thought, oh, this will be a quick one. And then it's like, oh, actually, this is a really interesting debate. So, yes, there was basically, when vaccination rates fall and we see resurgence in measles or rubella or whatever else, as there has been in this country and other European countries in recent years, there is this question of how do you increase vaccination rates to get herd immunity? And there tends to be a knee-jerk reaction which says, make it mandatory. And it was kind of, it was just interesting speaking to people about this. And so I'm just recalling all the people I spoke to. I mean, so California is
Were these crazy people? Were these crazy people who were against vaccination, or zealots who were saying, you know, we should enforce this?
Yeah, no. And it's funny, this sort of goes back to what we were talking about 10 minutes ago, is that I had a private conversation with a friend of mine who's not vaccinated her children. It didn't go in the piece. But I didn't go the route. I didn't feel there was a need to sort of speak to, maybe I should have done. I don't know. It's just choices you make. I spoke to a range of doctors and public health professionals. But what was telling was that in California, they've gone the route of mandatory vaccination, and it's not fixing the problem. And it's sort of creating, the more the government pushes mandatory vaccination, the more people resist. And so there's this sort of, there's almost this standoff when you keep seeing the legislation get tighter and tighter, and it's just not winning over people. And you know, that sort of anti-vaccination movement is fairly heavily fueled by anti-government sentiment and whatnot. And so the more one side pushes, the more the other side pushes back. And so just sort of speaking to some other people, a professor in London, whose name I'm forgetting, at the Institute of Child Health, and you know, she was just sort of saying that she thinks that actually there is a hardcore of anti-vaxxers, but there's also just a lot of people that forget to get their kids vaccinated, or there's a particular problem in London that people just move around so much that they just fall through the health system, and so her case was actually, if we invested the resources that we have, this is sort of always assuming slightly limited resources, that actually a better use of available resources, both in terms of person power and budget, is to actually go out and find the people. So she was talking about just a bus that went to low-income areas of London and just was there saying, if you haven't been vaccinated, come and get vaccinated. Mm. And there's been great success with that. So it was sort of like having faith in the public. And as we're talking about science communication, also just education campaigns. And so it was like, you know, people pick up on anti-vax sentiments and they're worried and it's terrifying. And when I took my children to get vaccinated, I was scared that something bad would happen.
Yeah.
Because we all are. That's how we react. And it's, you know, these things, these primordial fears get in our brains. And there are, there's real side effects of vaccines, and then there's invented side effects of vaccines. But it's a, it is a fearful thing to do. And it, the protection from a hypothetical disease is sort of exactly, it's not hypothetical, it's a real protection, but it's fairly abstract, whereas you're doing this thing. So yeah, so the other thing is to just sort of combat disinformation with information and investing in that. And another, you know, this is another thing of like GPs in this country and primary care physicians in the US, they sort of have 5-minute slots to see parents. And if a parent comes in and says, oh, I'm not sure about getting my children vaccinated, that might take a 30-minute, an hour conversation to actually make a dent in their apprehension. And that's not the resources to do it. So it was just interesting to see how you could have a rational based public health approach versus mandate it.
I mean, I don't know that there is a rational approach that will convince everyone, but I wonder how you feel about the kind of utilization of science communication. I'd probably in a pejorative way call it pseudoscience communication by on social media, for example, the sort of anti-vax things that appear on Facebook and so on.
Well, what can you do? I mean, it's not. Is that science communication or is that just propaganda? I don't think it's a specific science communication issue, is it? It's sort of.
Well, I suppose in the sense that do you think there's a role there to counter that, or is there an effective way of countering that, given that those appeals are probably broadly irrational, but yet they often claim to have, you know, a flavour of those science books you were talking about. You know, you've never thought about this, or what they don't want to tell you, or, you know,
sure,
the conspiracy theory, I suppose.
Well, yeah, there's conspiracy theory, certainly. But, I mean, I saw a tweet the other day saying there is no peer-reviewed study showing that vaccines are safe. I don't know. What do you do about that? That's just a plain lie. And it sort of uses, I mean, within, like, 10 words, it's sort of, there's no peer-reviewed thing. So it's almost as if, you know, I know what a peer-reviewed...
well, yes. I mean, even just recently, I think, probably on Twitter, because I tend to use Twitter a lot, that somebody talking about the whole kind of coronavirus thing, and but why would you trust a vaccination that's been rushed through?
I think that's actually the most rational objection to a COVID vaccine, isn't it? I mean, this is moving at light speed, and one has to trust that they're being very diligent about looking for side effects. But I think, I mean, you know, I have some sympathy with that. I mean, I think if there was one cause for uncertainty about a COVID vaccination, it would be that it would move very rapidly from the lab to the clinic. And I would hope they would do due diligence, and obviously I don't want to put anyone off it. It would be great to have a vaccine. That to me doesn't seem entirely irrational. I mean, if we're going to talk about COVID, I mean, it's just, I mean, the mask thing is a bigger issue for me. It's just like, or just more generally, that I really thought in March that this is such a pure science. Like, science is the way to combat a pandemic, right? I mean, it's like, we need treatments, we need prevention, you know, we need vaccines. We need to understand as much as we can about this virus. I mean, I just, like, science is the only way out of this situation. And I kind of thought in March, naively, that it would introduce a more scientific level of discourse. And you hear Angela Merkel speak and you think, in some places in the world, it has. And people are serious about talking seriously about this. But just, you know, being in the UK and obviously being exposed as we are to US politics so heavily, it just seems remarkable to me how much this is exposed. I mean, just the way that sort of Trump and Johnson treat coronavirus like they did Jeremy Corbyn and Hillary Clinton. I think the sort of same tricks will work on a virus. I mean, a virus just doesn't care about this. And I just thought the level of scientific discourse would go up. And it just hasn't. And it's bizarre, isn't it? I was just sort of thinking, like, I thought it might be an opportunity, and this probably sounds so grossly naive, that people would sort of learn about the scientific process. And that you would sort of hopefully see how one moves from a state of complete ignorance, as we were in March, to what one would hope to sort of finessing honing in on a greater understanding of this virus. And we still operate with headline-grabbing nonsense. You know, we all remember. You know, it was ibuprofen kills you if you've got coronavirus, and you know, smoking protects you. We'd still have these. I was sort of trying to work out what happened to all these stories the other day. And there's actually no reporting on them since the day they broke in April or May.
But that's kind of, so, suppose that's what I'm, because at times I think science is held in very low esteem at times, certainly in public discourse, I suppose. Scientists seeing scientists briefing anyone on television as we have over the last few months is unprecedented as far as I'm aware. And yet at the same time we get this kind of I hate to use the word, but I'm going to, because I can't think of an alternative, the kind of weaponization of science or scientistic language to make things which have no real evidence base plausible, or like you say, you know, there are no peer-reviewed papers that.
Well, I mean, I think every scientist and science writer and beyond got increasingly furious with the government's constant use of "we are following the science." I mean, there was no "the science" at the beginning. There is just science, and there are hypotheses, and you know, what the situation called for was transparency and to show us what bits of science they were using to inform their policies, instead of just, you know, parroting this line that they were following the science. And I mean, science works best and only works when it's completely transparent. And transparency is not a strong suit of this government or others. So yeah, it does get weaponized. And, you know, I'm sure if this Oxford vaccine does come through, it'll all be like Rule Britannia and, you know, God bless our scientists. And I don't know what the Oxford scientists would say about that. They might say we succeeded despite this government's policies. And also that their work on a vaccine was completely independent of the lockdown or the, you know, all the prevention policies that were put in place. I don't know. I would just like to have seen clearer messaging. And it's just...
Yeah.
And again, with the mask, you know, I've mentioned the mask, but it's like, as far as I can understand, you know, I've looked at the Nature Medicine paper, the PNAS paper, and there is good, strong evidence that masks help. And yeah, I don't know, in this country, I mean, even compared to America, it's sort of like, oh, you know, maybe we should wear masks, instead of sort of coming out and having a strong evidence-led campaign for why they're a good thing.
So there is a sort of failure of communication, not necessarily from scientists themselves, but from policymakers who are, as you say, appropriating science, the science that they're following.
Well, yeah, no, exactly. But I think Twitter has many good things and many bad things about it. But one of the good things is that, of course, that one can follow scientists that you trust, so sort of Richard Horton and Devi Sardar, and sort of get their take, you know, the take of serious professionals on this situation. So that is more democratic than having complete control over the message.
So there's definitely a role for science communicators. There's a need for them.
I believe so. Yeah, I mean, it's funny. It's funny. I've not written about COVID, and I kind of feel almost a personal guilt for not having interacted with the story of our times. My only excuse is I'm only just finishing my March to-do list right now. So maybe I'll do that. But yeah, no, of course. I mean, Ed Yong, who's a fantastic journalist, works at The Atlantic now. You know, some of his, he's written 3, 4, 5 long form pieces that have been fantastic, you know, very well resourced, very clearly communicated.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there's many others as well that I'm forgetting. There was a piece that I read via an online link, so I'm forgetting which publication it was. There was an account, and I wish I could remember the author's name, because it was a fantastic, fantastic story, just describing UCLH at peak pandemic. And he just hit the
author, really?
It was a him, just accompanied the consultant on the wards, and it was one of the most stunning stories I've read. And just like the absolute...
Oh well, let me know what it is afterwards, and I'll put it on a link in the description of the podcast.
It did describe how, like, there was basically the people who run UCLH were basically talking to the people running hospitals in northern Italy and preparing for the pandemic because the government weren't taking charge. That was one of the most memorable lines in it, other than just the pure emotional toll on the doctor and his staff. So of course I believe in science communicators. Yeah, I mean, I like I said, it's funny. I think I have, you know, we spoke about styles of writing, and I think I come from, coming as an academic, one, I think it brings with it a certain heritage. And so I think I probably was most comfortable with writing, you know, science writing and, like, you know, isn't biology amazing sort of stuff? Isn't research cool? And so the journalistic stuff is sort of more stuff that I'm learning to do, and I want to be able to do it well. But, you know, just stuff like Ed Yong has done, or the stuff, the story I'm just writing about. Yeah, I mean, I think it's really important. These journalists are just going in on the ground and telling the true stories. Yeah, I think that's vitally, vitally important.
Before we move on, I was going to ask you about your new book in a minute, your children's book. So we can trail that. But I was just looking at my scribbled notes here and thinking about connections. And connections as clearly beaten autocorrect as any kind of unifying theme. But I would like
just to know a bit more about why you chose it.
Because I thought it was a connection with the whole artificial augmented intelligence thing, and the extent to which I suppose what I was kind of working towards is the boundaries of the human. And I did this cartoon a years ago, which I uncovered actually just the other day. I had it printed on a T-shirt. It's a pie chart, and about 15% of it is shaded in. It says my brain, and the rest of it is Google. I think the caption is my capacity for thought. And there is a sense in which we are all augmented by the technology. And I suppose it feeds into what you're talking about, your piece about neuroethics. You know, issues like self-driving cars and even online, you know, the fact that so much content now is automatically produced, and some news outlets have computer written content rather than journalists.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny you say that. I was literally thinking about autocorrect yesterday. So my daughter's a grandparent adopted an endangered animal for them, and they got their letter from the WWF, and it said, if you want to know more, if you have further questions about your animal, go to our website and look at the frequently asked questions section. So it was this sort of big promise that if you have a question, it's like my kids will have hundreds of questions.
Yeah.
But it's like, go to the website and you can basically have an answer to one of our 10 pre-specified questions. So,
yeah.
You know, it's like they're not offering you access to an expert or someone who knows the subject intimately who will take the time to listen to your question and answer it and tailor their answer to your query. And I also, this actually led to me thinking about autocorrect a bit more. And so I don't know if you use Gmail. I use Gmail. I don't know, a few months, they sort of started with these sort of choose one of these three replies, which I think everyone hated. But now they've introduced this quite aggressive autocomplete function on it.
Yeah.
And the thing is, even if you don't like it, you are offered the temptation every time you write. And so, and sort of, you know, two-thirds of the time, it does get the context right, and it offers you the option to press one button, which will auto-complete your sentence. Yeah. But you will auto-complete it using a very standard way of speaking. And so it's like,
yeah,
you start typing, and you may have an urge to express yourself in an interesting way, which might be tailored to the person you're writing to. But you are, as soon as you start writing that sentence, you are offered the stereotypical standard way of finishing it.
Yeah.
And we're all in a rush. So you sort of press it. And so I don't like it. So it came up in the context of the piece I wrote about sort of brain-computer interfaces last year.
Yeah.
And, you know, when philosophers think about this, they do see it as a fundamental diminishment of human autonomy. And so the question is, if I could press the autocorrect function in this email, who was the author of that line? You know, we'd like to think, oh, I wrote it. But actually, I don't know, Google kind of suggested it. And so the sort of technology can just sort of lead you down paths. And it just, I don't know, it just seems to just sort of diminish human individuality
I think it probably goes beyond that, doesn't it? Because it's also the Google algorithm training you to express yourself in certain ways. Yeah,
and of course we all know that sort of Google, the Google algorithms. You know, if there's a fight to be at the top of those, isn't there? So, you know, whoever Googles COVID symptoms, you know, they're going to get the same answer. I mean, with COVID symptoms, you would hope the top answer would be the most definitive list. But just in terms of creativity. Whoever paid the most or whatever.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, so it's just...
But I mean, it's an interesting... It brings us kind of full circle in the sense that this is an instance where the choice of words, the way you communicate, is actually dictated by something external, somebody else's design, somebody else's algorithm. And it's a kind of act of resistance to say, I'm not going to use that. I'm not going to use autocorrect. Yeah. I'm going to take responsibility for my own communication. And you have to, as with all these, you know, talking about vaccinations and so on, you have to kind of understand the implications of that bit of science before you can make your decision, don't you? You have to understand what the implications are of just going with the flow or believing a story that you read on Facebook rather than investigating.
Yeah.
So education is pretty fundamental.
Yeah. It's funny. One experience that a lot of science writers and presumably all journalists have online is that I put up stories and the editor has designed a headline to be as catchy as possible and the little subtitle stand first as well. Mm. And it's incredible how often the comments, but the only logical response to the comments I get is to say, read the story.
Yes.
People will say, but you didn't, da, da, da. And it's like, that's in paragraph 5. You know, that's in paragraph 8. I've done that. And so it can be really, I mean, what really annoys me about crappy, dishonest communication, or it's just how lazy it is. You know, I, as I said earlier, I feel a huge obligation to try and get everything as right as possible. And that requires hard work, you know? And it's like, I'm not saying I can do everything in 3 weeks, but I'll do everything I can to give you the best oversight of a topic I can. You know, as fair as I can muster it, because that's a value I hold dear. And so just to sort of, you know, just from a very personal standpoint, just to see cheap disinformation out there, it's just really disheartening. And yes, all you want from your reader is some critical thinking and a willingness to read the whole article.
That's probably quite fundamental, but it's also probably one of the reasons why Twitter is so corrosive sometimes, because people don't react to what's actually being said, and what's being said in any case doesn't have a great deal of depth. I do strive to read the source. If I'm going to comment on anything, you know, if somebody's put a link to an article, it's best to read the actual article rather than just respond to the response to the response to the response. But it is interesting how all these systems, I talk about them as systems, but I mean, all these technologies are kind of often invisible. You know, we just adopt them, we just adapt to them, and they, the way they shape our behavior, and increasingly and obviously most recently, the way they shape our thoughts. Mm. And so, you know, I think that's probably feeds into what we're saying about the weaponization of scientific terms or scientific credentials. You know, the whole environment thing is probably the best example of that, the whole kind of anthropogenic global warming.
Yeah, I mean, all of these issues, all of them are just so, so complicated. And just, yeah, like you say, we're living in a world of technological platforms which are give us fragments of information and sort of play on our emotions and want to get a reaction out of us. And, I mean, we all believed it was going to be the great, democratic process, giving everyone a voice. And it has done that, but it's also done something rather corrosive and has reduced debate. And it's just simply very frustrating, isn't it?
Yes, but I suppose that means you do have to take great care about who you take notice of, and it's good that that there are, as you say, responsible and careful writers and researchers on these platforms as well, that you can hopefully you can kind of pick out and follow and so on and it's a bit like controlling your diet, isn't it? It's kind of, you have to choose what you eat carefully. You have to take some responsibility for that. There's so much else we could have talked about. I mean, I was going to talk about gender as well, because there's sort of a whole thing about X and Y chromosomes. I think is that mentioned in your book, or is I think so.
I do have a chapter.
Yes, on yeah, and how it's not that simple. And it's not universal. And that's fascinating as well. I mean, again, you know, that's fascinating in the context of all the debates about gender and transgender and, you know, what constitutes male and female. It's a fascinating debate when people are trying to make a claim to the scientific basis of gender. But we'll just have to come back to that another time.
If we came back to that, I would want to do a lot of reading up. I feel that evolving concept that I could talk to you about the nuts and bolts of Y chromosomes, but gender is.
It's the kind of connection, I suppose, between biological sex and gender and.
No, precisely.
Oh, incidentally, I did. I think there's probably quite a good connection here. I think it's a good connection. So you can tell us what a fetal Doppler is, can't you? I'm testing you there. Fetal Doppler.
I'm not sure. I can't tell you what a fetal.
Oh, it's a scan. It's a scan. It's a scan that listens to a baby's heartbeat. You know, it's the sort of thing that American couples buy because they want to hear listen to their baby. Anyway, but Christian Doppler, physicist, Austrian physicist. I just wrote these notes down, so I'm just telling you. It might be interesting. Who made a contribution to what became known as a Doppler effect. I understand that the French don't call it a Doppler effect because of another scientist involved. But he ended up in the University of Vienna, and one of his pupils was Gregor Mendel. And that was surprised me because I always thought Gregor Mendel was much older than physics, if you see what I mean, in that sense. And that sort of, but there's a connection. Anyway, that's all I'm saying. It was your word.
Yes, it's funny. Gregor Mendel is often portrayed as this sort of lone monk who was just up in the monastery rediscovering redefining biology. But actually, he was quite a well-networked guy. He wasn't just some eccentric monk.
Well, so as I say, we're going to come on to your children's book. You mentioned it briefly at the beginning. This is Dorling Kinsley. Do you know when it's going to be out?
It's going to be out next spring. It's been a really fun project. Like I say, it's 7 to 9 year olds, and it's basically 32 two-page spreads, each one with a sort of key idea in neuroscience, and starting with what is a brain, what does a brain do, and I think it's just been a really interesting exercise to sort of try and convey the sort of heart of an idea in sort of 3 or 4 pictures and 200 odd words. And obviously, like I said, it's very much a collaborative project with them. And they're obviously immense expertise in children's books, well, in all books, but, these illustrated books. So it's been really good fun just to sort of come up. I'd come up with the key ideas, send them a bad PowerPoint presentation with sort of key points on it, and they've sent me back these illustrations. So, we've got sort of, how does a brain grow from conception to birth? And then how does the brain change from birth to adulthood and then adulthood into old age? Sort of sensory systems, memory, how we learn, a few bits on evolution.
And it's not a pop-up.
The animations are so good, they do look like they pop out of the page, but they are strictly 2D.
Good. All right. Well, listen, thank you so much for spending this time. I think we've had an hour or something, and it hasn't seemed like it. And I'm particularly pleased that we got through the whole thing without mentioning tapirs.
I saw a tweet of a tapir and that piece of tapir anatomy that I wrote about in the book. So, I was reminded.
It's ever popular, but I'll leave the readers to find that for themselves.
Yes, exactly.
But thank you very much.
Yeah, and
I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. It's been very good.
So that was Liam Drew, and he was talking to me about his book, I, Mammal, which came out in paperback last year. So if you'd like to read that, and I do recommend it, particularly when you get to the bit about the tapir, which we didn't talk about. Yeah, it's normally $9.99, but if you order it from Mr. Books, you get it for just $7.99 if you use the code IDEASINWRITING. If you want to order it online, of course, you can go to mrbooks.co.uk/iMammal. That's all one word. It's iMammal. If you want it delivered, then, of course, there's a postage and packing charge, of course. What else can I tell you? Well, coming up in the next month, we're doing a couple of good recordings. Hopefully, they'll happen with the fabulous Arthur Smith, the godfather of comedy and the Edinburgh Fringe and walking tours around Arthur's seat, and so much to talk about. And he's got a couple of books out, which I know you'll enjoy. Also, with hopefully speaking to Giles Paley-Phillip, who's an experienced children's author and also a podcaster. And he's just brought out a new book. And I've got to check the title. Hang on. 152 Days. It's, well, I'll tell you about that when we get to speaking to Giles. But anyway, depending on when these happen, we might try and slot one or two more guests in over the next couple of months. But if you've got an idea for a guest or a future podcast, or you'd like to join in a listeners reading group in the future, just email Mr. Books. Ideas in Writing is produced with the support of Mr. Books Bookshop in Tunbridge, the home of inspiring, imaginative and intelligent books, gifts and conversation. You can find it at mrbooks.co.uk and on Twitter at mrbooks_ton, T-O-N for Tunbridge, to order all kinds of books, new and secondhand, or you can visit them. And I recommend you visit them because it's awfully quiet at the moment. It's open Wednesday to Saturday, 10 till 5, and you can pick up a brilliant book for just a few pounds. Thanks for listening. See you next time. Hello, if you enjoyed this podcast, you can support us. Just need to click on the link and become an Acast supporter. It's a one-off donation. You can give as much or as little as you like, and there's no commitment, but it certainly helps us to keep producing these podcasts. So thank you very much.